Iran once again slams the stance of the US, Britain, some EU states on the recent riots in the country, pledging to respond to any unconstructive measure by the West. Lebanon's lawmakers failed to elect a successor to outgoing President Michel Aoun for the fourth time as long-running political disagreements persist. The United Nations has suspended the work of its torture inspectors in Australia after authorities prevented their access to several prisons. World News. We're live from the Iranian capital, Tehran. Thank you very much for joining us. Now, top story, Iran says the prerequisites for the revival of the 2015 nuclear deal are clear, but the U.S. seems to lack the political will to return to the accord. The foreign ministry spokesman says Iran is ready to revive the accord as soon as the U.S. offers guarantees on its commitments to the terms. Nasser Kanani says, however, that the U.S. is hypocritical. Americans have been sending several messages to Iran expressing their readiness to return to the accord. He says this is while Washington is simultaneously supporting the riots in Iran, claiming it has shelved the negotiations for now. The spokesman says the U.S. can't win concessions from Iran through threats or provocations. He also slammed the stance of some EU states and Britain on the recent riots in Iran, saying Tehran will respond to unconstructive measures by the West. Lebanon's parliament fails to elect a new president for a fourth time, just days before the incumbent's term ends. In a vote held just hours ago, presidential candidates fell short of acquiring the minimum 86 ballots needed to be elected. That's after nearly half of the lawmakers left their votes blank. Parliament Speaker Nabih Berri has called for another vote on Thursday in the hope of overcoming the impasse. A power vacuum could deepen the political crisis in Lebanon, which is already governed by a caretaker cabinet. The impasse is rooted in a constitutional requirement for power sharing based on a confessional system. Current President Michel Aoun also took power in 2016 after a two-year vacancy at the presidential palace. Several explosions have been heard in the Syrian capital, Damascus. Syrian media say the Israeli regime has carried out new strikes on the city. Let's bring in our correspondent in Damascus, Muhammad Ali, for more details on that. Muhammad, so a very rare instance of Israel, which has regularly attacked Syria, but this time during the day.
Yes, exactly. Well, definitely it's not the first time that such airstrikes on Syria happen in the day, but as you have just said, it rarely happens at that time. Now, just to be accurate, there is still no confirmation by any side that this was an Israeli attack. It is believed to be so, but officially speaking, state media said that explosions were heard in the skies of Damascus, and there is no further information yet. We're still waiting to see if there will be kind of a statement from an official source to give some details on what happened, but it is believed, looking at what has been happening in Syria, that this is an Israeli strike, because Israel almost on a weekly basis attacks and uses its fighter jets or surface-to-surface missiles fired from the occupied Golan on various parts of Syria, focusing most of the time on Damascus and its countryside. Of course, this is illegal. It is against international law, the sovereignty of Syria, and the UN Charter, yet there is still international silence over such strikes. And this strike comes just following several days of an Israeli strike also around Damascus International Airport. We also have to point out that Israel does not just attack Syrian government or military places inside Syria or sites, but it had previously attacked the Damascus International Airport itself, the runway, endangering the lives of civilians. So this is not a surprise for the Syrian government to see more and more Israeli strikes, but usually the Syrian government makes it clear that such strikes by Israel are in support of the remaining terrorist groups inside Syria.
Mohammed, thank you very much indeed for that. Mohammed Ali there, our correspondent, joining us live from the Syrian capital, Damascus. South and North Koreas have reported the exchange of warning shots near their maritime borders as tensions between the two neighbors show no sign of abating. South Korean media say warning shots were fired at a North Korean vessel after it violated the de facto maritime border. The media also cited the North's military as saying that a South Korean military ship crossed the border, prompting it to fire 10 rounds of warning shots. The border, known as the Northern Limit Line, has been a flashpoint in the years-long conflict between Seoul and Pyongyang. The latest development comes amid a flurry of missile launches as well as shows of strength on the Korean Peninsula. Pyongyang has test-fired several missiles over the past weeks. That's in reaction to joint military drills by Seoul, Tokyo, and Washington. The North calls those drills a rehearsal for invasion. Our correspondent Frank Smith earlier joined us from Seoul with the latest on the muscle flexing in the Korean Peninsula.
Well, according to South Korea's Joint Chiefs of Staff, it was a merchant vessel of North Korea that crossed over, and then according to North Korea, it was a South Korean military vessel that crossed what it recognizes as the de facto maritime border on the West Sea, the west side of the peninsula. This really highlights the kind of tension that exists on the Korean Peninsula. We've got a new president here in South Korea, Yoon Suk-yeol, that wants to take a hard line with North Korea and respond sort of more aggressively to what it sees as so-called provocations. And this includes, in particular, North Korea's missile testing that has really ramped up this year to include one intermediate-range ballistic missile that even crossed over to Japan. And we've seen South Korea test missiles and conduct large-scale military exercises, the largest joint U.S.-South Korea drills on the Korean Peninsula in 5 years. Now, this does also carry risk that I think the two sides and the U.S. need to really recognize. A couple of South Korean missiles actually malfunctioned, one landing just 700 meters from a residential area. So, while these sort of cross-border clashes and military testing and military drills take place, the two sides need to recognize, again, the risks involved here.
The United Nations has suspended the work of its torture inspectors in Australia after authorities prevented their access to several prisons. The inspectors called the decision drastic and a response to Australia's breach of its international obligations. A former inspector is also calling Australia's move an embarrassing debacle for which Canberra should be held accountable. Australia has until January 2023 to meet its obligations. A failure to do so could place Australia on the list of countries with significant human rights concerns. Rights groups have repeatedly accused Australia of abusing the rights of prisoners, especially Aboriginal communities, in its detention centres and immigration compounds. Director of the Center for Counter-Hegemonic Studies, Tim Anderson, earlier gave us his take on the suspension of UN anti-torture mission to Australia.
Australia is in a very, very similar situation to Canada in many respects. They both have preached human rights. They've even gone and bombed people in other countries in the name of human rights. But when it comes to the rights of Indigenous people and vulnerable people here, there's been huge crimes and crimes that have been covered up for many, many years. So I think it's really the shame that's going to come to Australia, that very few countries have failed in their obligations to allow these UN inspectors to go in and look at the prisons candidly, unannounced. That's part of their job, is to go in unannounced so they can see what's going on rather than a show being set up for them. But this is one of those countries that I live in, and unfortunately, that is saying we're not going to do that. We'll preach human rights to the rest of the world, but when it comes to UN inspection of our own vulnerable groups, we won't allow it.
Turning elsewhere now, a terrorist attack on a hotel in Somalia's southern port city of Kismayo leaves 9 people dead and 47 others wounded. The attack happened on Sunday when a booby-trapped car rammed into the entrance of the hotel. All 4 attackers, including a suicide bomber, were killed by security forces. The Al-Shabaab terror group has claimed responsibility,
saying the target was members of the federal government of Jubaland who were meeting in the hotel. The group has been waging a deadly insurgency against Somalia's fragile government for more than a decade. The Al-Qaeda-linked outfit often carries out attacks against government, military, and civilian targets in the capital, Mogadishu, as well as regional towns. Members and supporters of Morocco's main trade union have staged a demonstration in the capital, Rabat, to protest the high cost of living and the government's inaction to address the issue. The rally organized by the National Union of Labour in Morocco was held outside Parliament. Protesters slammed the government for failing to curb rising prices. The demonstration came after several protests already held this week in Rabat and other cities across the nation. Inflation was well over 8% year-on-year in September due to surging food prices, which were up 14.7%. Fuel prices have also increased sharply, making Moroccans all the more furious. Former British Prime Minister Boris Johnson has pulled out of the ruling party's leadership contest, which would have let him return to power within weeks of having been ousted. Johnson claims he had secured the backing of 102 lawmakers, but he has fallen short of reaching a unity with two contenders, Rishi Sunak and Penny Mordaunt. Sunak now looks set to become next Prime Minister, as he reportedly enjoys the backing of almost 150 lawmakers so far. Sunak had stepped down from Johnson's cabinet in July. That triggered a torrent of resignations and forced Johnson himself to quit. The British government has been dealing with political chaos since Liz Truss stepped down over her controversial tax-slashing plans last week. A new survey has found millions of households in Britain are skipping meals as they struggle with the country's deepening cost of living crisis. The findings show inflation returns to a 40-year high after food prices soar. Saeed Poreza reports from London.
It's been just a few weeks since the now resigned Prime Minister, Liz Truss, promised low taxes and high growth. Events have moved incredibly fast in Westminster, that a new finance minister is now raising taxes and promising public sector cuts. The U-turns and counter-U-turns have come with a cost for the economy and the people. A new study has found that millions of households are skipping meals or struggling to put healthy foods on the table. Inflation is already at more than 10%. Energy and fuel prices are on the rise, putting a squeeze on Britain's finances.
Well, the start of all this is Brexit. Brexit led to Boris incompetence. It led to falling living standards. It led to Liz Truss and further incompetence. And Britain basically voted to become poorer by leaving the EU. You can blame some of it on money printing at the Bank of England, inflation taking out, you know, and lowering living standards as well. So it's a combination of things.
A combination of things that have toppled two prime ministers in the span of 1 year.
It's been less than 2 months since Boris Johnson gave way to Liz Truss as prime minister, followed by the death of the Queen and a dramatic change in the country's economic outlook. And now, yet another leadership contest that could trigger even more economic and political instability.
And more instability means more people relying on charities, from food banks to keep their stomachs full, and warm rooms where those unable to heat their homes can take refuge in the cold months of winter. The new chancellor has curbed Liz Truss's flagship economic plan of a 2-year cap on energy bills to April next year. And at the end of this month, he's expected to announce a midterm economic policy that could spell out the beginning of another prolonged period of austerity.
Whoever takes over, Boris, Rishi, Mordaunt, who knows, but the outlook continues to be bad because inflation is still out of control. There's not the money or the government finances to give the public sector further wage rises to match that inflation. Strikes will continue. The fiscal position of the country remains dire. partly because we have a smaller economy because of Brexit. So there's no easy solution. There's no easy way out of this. The hole has been dug, and it's very deep and very difficult to climb out of.
Paying the price of that, ordinary Britons, as the Conservative Party races to choose its third leader and prime minister in 1 year, urgent help to those in need couldn't come any sooner. Saeed Puriza, London.
Ukrainian President Volodymyr Zelensky dismisses as false Russia's warning that Kiev is preparing to use a dirty bomb in the ongoing war. Zelensky accused Moscow of fabricating stories about possible provocations by Kiev. Ukraine's foreign minister also rejected Russia's claims as, quote, absurd and dangerous. The two officials responded to Russia's defense minister, who had separate phone calls with some of his NATO counterparts, warning that the war in Ukraine is rapidly spiraling out of control. Now, Sergei Shoigu told the French, British and Turkish defense ministers that Ukraine could stage a provocation with what he called a dirty bomb. UK Defence Secretary Ben Wallace, however, refuted Moscow's claims that Western countries were facilitating a planned escalation of the war. The French president says Ukrainians will have to decide when peace is possible in the current war gripping their country. Speaking at a peace summit in the Italian capital, Rome, Emmanuel Macron said peace must not be held hostage to Russian power. Macron acknowledged that calling for peace could be hard to accept for those fighting for their homeland, but as he stressed, it is necessary to have the courage to want peace. He also said peace can be achieved at the negotiating table with Moscow. Macron has faced criticism over his repeated calls to negotiate with Russian President Vladimir Putin. In his speech, Macron also praised Western backing for Kiev. As the war in Ukraine continues to rage, our reporter Johnny Miller investigates allegations that the Ukrainian army is killing pro-Russian civilians in areas that it retakes.
A refugee camp somewhere in the Luhansk region of Donbass. The civilians here are Russian speakers who fled recent Ukrainian advances not far to the west. Now, the people here won't speak to me. They are simply too scared. I've also been told not to give the exact location of this site or even the town that we're in fear that the Ukrainians might target the center with artillery strikes. They also tell me that they are scared to be put on Telegram channels called Collaborators of Luhansk. It posts the photos and details of anyone accused of working with the Russians. It includes teachers and nurses. Along the battle lines, pro-Ukrainians generally flee west. Pro-Russians flee east. The ethnic boundaries of this once mixed country are being defined more clearly. While this is a proxy war between Russia and NATO, it is also, at its root, a civil war between Ukrainian nationalists and its Russian-speaking minority, who are mainly situated in the east and the south of the country. The fact of the matter is, there is a strong likelihood, even a probability, that if Ukraine was to ever take back these four regions, there would be ethnic cleansing of the Russian-speaking population. The people here in Donbass say that this attempted ethnic cleansing by the Ukrainian army has been going on for the last 8 years. While Russia and NATO continue to pursue their objectives on the battlefield, there is increasingly a peace to be made and new borders drawn if the views of the people living here were listened to. Johnny Miller, Donbass.
And that brings an end to our bulletin for this hour, but don't go away.
Is there any other way to get familiar with Islam besides mainstream media? Try IRIB English Radio. log on to our website, www.parstoday.com/en.
Bismillahirrahmanirrahim.
Assalamu alaykum wa rahmatullah.
Selection of Ayatollah Khamenei's viewpoints.
Hame ba wujood ghudde saratani Israel mukhalifin.
All of us are opposed to the cancer's tumor, Israel.
وجه مشترک همه وحدت امت اسلامی.
Unity of Islamic Ummah is the aspect that all of Islamic denominations have in common.
Faith based on understanding. Saturday, the 4th of Ramadan, 1394, 21st of September, 1974. There is a story about the leaders of one of the communist nations of the Eastern Bloc, who professed atheism and utterly rejected any culture or philosophy that was not based on materialism. This story takes place shortly after the Indian independence. In order to win the hearts of the massed millions of Indians who have just won their independence, these leaders visit India. Some of the most important Muslim leaders were Maulana Shah Mahmud Dehlawi, Maulana Mahmud al-Hassan, Maulana Abul Kalam Azad, Maulana Muhammad Ali, and Maulana Shaukat Ali. The term Maulana amongst Indian Muslims at the time is roughly equivalent to our term Ayatollah. Therefore, these Muslim scholars were amongst the major leaders of the Indian independence movement. There were also Hindu figures such as Mahatma Gandhi, and figures belonging to the Jain faith were also a part of it. Coming back to Tilak, he was a Hindu monk, although perhaps monk is not the proper term, but in any case, he was a Hindu religious leader and an amazing figure. He really was quite a remarkable person, although he died while the struggle was ongoing and did not live to see a free India. However, 30 years, 40 years after his death, his followers saw his vision for a free India realized and wore the Tilak mark to memorialize him. This mark is a religious symbol with spiritual and metaphysical significance. And Tilak himself was, for the Hindus, a religious leader.
دنیای اسلام یک
The world of Islam has one single prescription today, and that is unity. This prescription exists in all Islamic countries. Nations should be united.
In any case, when these communist leaders who espoused atheism and materialism went to India, in order to win people over to their cause, they put the Tilak mark on their heads. In other words, they wanted to say, yes, us too, we believe the same as you. This, even though their own words and beliefs contradicted this statement. Those political leaders who are removed from spiritual, religious, or divine responsibilities are like this. But the prophets of Allah believed in whatever they spoke with the totality of their being. Whatever they called people towards, they were rushing towards it already. It means nothing if I lay down at the bottom of a mountain, dying of thirst, and tell you there is a cool, fresh water to be had on the top of this mountain. Quick, go and get it. Hurry, I'll be waiting here. You would all be right to tell me, if what you're saying is true, if you really knew there was a spring atop this mountain, when you yourself are dying of thirst, you would have gone yourself. You must be lying, for you yourself do not believe what you have said. Therefore, divine leaders must, before anyone else, like trailblazers with the banner in their hands, set out on the path, stand tall and lead the way for others to follow.
Allah, I wanna thank you. I wanna thank you for all the things that you've done.
Wildfires in Greece, Turkey, the United States.
Palestinian prisoners in Israeli jails continue to engage in hunger strikes.
Kim Yo-jong, the powerful sister of North Korean leader.
On the news line.
Twitter account of UN Human Rights Council addressed the report published by the three-member commission and shared the link to it. The title of the report very clearly addresses the occupation to be unlawful under international law with zero ambiguity. The report states the reason for the conclusion to be the permanence of the occupation as well as Israel's de facto annexation policies. Navi Pillai, chair of the commission, stated, "Recent statements by the Secretary General and numerous member states have clearly indicated that any attempt at unilateral annexation of a state's territory by another is a violation of international law and is null and void. 143 member states, including Israel, last week voted in favor of a General Assembly resolution reaffirming this." The chair also further added, "Unless universally applied, including to the situation in the occupied Palestinian territory, this core principle of the United Nations Charter will become meaningless." The 28-page report published by Navanethem Pillai, Milun Kothari, and Christopher Sidoti highlights the sustenance and the advancement of the settlement enterprise, and the continuous expansion over the past couple of years that resulted in many Palestinian families to be forced out of their homes only for foreigners who've never been to the land to occupy their homes.
Yaakov, you know this is not your house.
Yes, but if I go, you don't go back. So what's the problem? What are you yelling at me? I didn't do this.
But you're
easy to yell at me, but I didn't do this.
Yeah, you are stealing my house.
And if I don't steal it, someone else is going to steal it.
No one is allowed to steal it, Yammi.
Statements by Israeli officials that showed their intention to maintain permanent control over the expanding settlements were also noted in the reports and were part of the reason why the occupation was declared unlawful. Chair of the commission also recognized the direct and indirect transferring of Israelis into the settlements as a plan to ensure permanent Israeli control in the West Bank. Independent International Commission of Inquiry on the Occupied Palestinian Territory, including Al-Quds and in Israel. That is the name that the UN gave to the commission in May of 2021 when the UN Human Rights Council held a special session on the grave human rights situation in the occupied Palestinian territory. During the session, the UNHRC decided to establish an urgent international commission of inquiry to investigate alleged human rights violations in the occupied Palestinian territories at the hands of Israel. The recent report is the culmination of what the three-member council has found during the past year and a half in what seems to be an uncharacteristically direct accusation of Israeli human rights violation and breaking of international law. Let's take a quick look at some of the bullet points mentioned in the report. An allusion to the core principles of the UN on annexation, which Israel seems to have also agreed to, even though it has violated it. The existence of a settlement enterprise and the efforts to make settlement permanent, violating the rights of Palestinians who were forced to leave as settlers took their homes by force. Israelis' exploitation of land and natural resources, the restrictive urban planning and zoning policies that seize Palestinian construction as an impediment to settlements that result in frequent confiscation of land, demolition of homes, and eventually displacement. The silent harm and psychological trauma resulting from erosion of economic, social, and cultural rights of Palestinians in a coercive environment that fragments the Palestinian society. The necessity of international action as Israeli government's actions are seen by the Commission as criminal, particularly its direct and indirect transfer of civilian population into occupied and annexed territories. The report seems to be a step in the right direction for the UN to fulfill its sole responsibility of standing up for human rights violations globally. But whether or not the criminal accusations towards Israel will lead to an International Court of Justice investigation and trial remains to be seen, especially when Israel has the unwavering support of the US.
Iran has doubled down on its earlier stance that it has not supplied weapons to Russia to be used against Ukraine. Foreign ministry officials say those claims are untrue and based on false information. Tehran says the accusations are part of a propaganda campaign by the West to stoke tensions with Iran. The accusations against Iran have been leveled by Ukraine and its Western backers. They say Russia has been using Iranian-made drones to strike Ukrainian cities in recent weeks. The Kremlin has also roundly denied the accusation, saying it's using Russia-made weapons in its strikes. Also, some Western media outlets have cited US security officials as saying that more Iranian drones as well as missiles are to be shipped to Russia. But the Pentagon says it cannot confirm those reports. However, it says it will take steps to make the sale of Iranian drones harder. Ukraine has also threatened to cut diplomatic ties with Iran. But Tehran says it holds a neutral stance and believes dialogue is the best way to end the war. Iran has invariably stressed the need for respect for various countries' sovereignty, independence, and territorial integrity, including Ukraine, based on the principles of the United Nations Charter.
The Islamic Republic of Iran has taken a clear and consistent position on the situation in Ukraine, which has been pronounced since the start of the conflict. The Islamic Republic of Iran has always emphasized that all UN members must fully respect the purpose and principles enshrined in the United Nations Charter as well as applicable international law.
The accusations against Iran come amid intensifying tensions at war fronts in Ukraine. Citizens and pro-Russian officials are evacuating from the main city in Kherson region just as Ukrainian forces are pushing to take back the area from Russia. Over 60,000 people will be evacuated within the next 6 days. The anti-Iran claims first emerged in July, Back then, U.S. National Security Advisor Jake Sullivan alleged that Washington had received, quote, information indicating that Iran was preparing to provide Russia with up to several hundred unmanned aerial vehicles, including weapons-capable UAVs, on an expedited timeline. Flying at low altitude, these unmanned aircraft can evade traditional air defense systems before dive bombing their targets. The distinctive delta wing design of the drones has led Ukrainian and Western officials to claim that they are Iranian Shahed-136 UAVs. Russia's use of the so-called kamikaze drones has sparked panic in Ukraine. The United States, Britain and France were planning to raise the claim during a closed-door UN Security Council meeting. They accuse Iran of violating a UN Security Council resolution that had placed an arms embargo on Iran. The arms embargo expired in 2020, despite the efforts of former US President Donald Trump to renew it.
Iran categorically rejected unfounded and unsubstantiated claims that Iran has transferred UAVs for the use of the conflict in Ukraine. It is recently disappointing that to pursue their political agenda, these states are trying to launch a disinformation campaign against Iran.
So, dear colleagues, today we have observed another round of the disinformation campaign from the Security Council by the Western delegations, as they raised in the Council the issue of the UAVs allegedly used by Russia in Ukraine. The aim of our Western colleagues is clear. They attempt to hit two targets at once, inventing an artificial pretext to put pressure on Russia and on Iran.
The accusations come amid continued NATO military support for Ukraine. The West is now under fire for fanning the flames of war by sending more and more military hardware there. It's now believed that the accusations made against Iran are part of a larger media campaign against the Islamic Republic. The West, led by the United States, were trying to pressurize Iran by supporting the rioters in Iran during the recent tensions. They imposed a series of sanctions on Iranian officials over human rights allegations. However, they failed to dictate their will on Iran.
France is facing protests over the cost of living crisis fueled by soaring inflation. Police have clashed with the protesters, venting anger in the capital, Paris. Protesters were met with police brutality. Police used batons to disperse the protesters, who were throwing rocks at security forces. There are calls by trade unions for a nationwide transport strike. Unions now say it is time to expand the industrial action at oil refineries to other sectors. Protesters and strikers say they need pay rise to cope with the soaring cost of living. France is now experiencing inflation at 6.2%. That is the highest rate in decades. Striking workers are demanding higher wages from the profits of energy companies amid high oil and gas prices. Protesters have demanded emergency measures against high prices, including freezes in the cost of energy. The industrial action has taken offline more than 60% of France's refining capacity. Macron's government is also on the defensive in Parliament, where it has lost its majority in legislative elections in June. It is much more difficult for his centrist alliance to implement his agenda against strengthened opponents. France is not the only country in Europe that is facing protests. European countries are facing more strikes and protests due to high energy prices and the mounting cost of living. The UK economy shrank by 0.3% in August. It experienced a 10.2% inflation rate in September, which was the highest in 40 years. The latest data shows that inflation rose on average to 10.9% across the European Union. Europe faces a very difficult economic climate if the current energy crisis worsens, with winter temperatures likely to be a decisive factor.
The European Union has imposed sanctions on Iran over its response to recent riots in the country.
The sanctions list includes 11 individuals and 4 entities and targets a section of Iran's police, the Basij Volunteer Forces, and the cyber division of the country's Islamic Revolution Guards Corps. The Iranian Information Minister is also blacklisted. The coercive measures include travel bans and asset freezes. The sanctions were imposed during a meeting of EU foreign ministers. The move drew strong condemnation from Tehran, with the Iranian Foreign Ministry promising reciprocal bans on European officials and entities.
The Islamic Republic of Iran will make a reciprocal and proportionate reaction.
Iran's foreign ministry has described the EU sanctions as a violation of international law and a clear example of meddling in the country's internal affairs. The ministry also accused the bloc of bias and using human rights as a means to achieve political goals. Iran's foreign minister Hossein Amir Abdullahian also took to Twitter to dismiss the sanctions as futile and based on false allegations.
Down a well-worn path of ineffective sanctions, the EU today adopted further superfluous sanctions on Iranian persons. It is an unconstructive act out of miscalculation based on widespread disinformation. Riots and vandalism are not tolerated anywhere. Iran is no exception.
The EU and its member states had already acquired a reputation as major violators of human rights in Iran due to their inaction and endorsement of harsh US sanctions on the country. In the statement, the EU condemned what it called the widespread and disproportionate use of force against peaceful protesters in Iran. The EU foreign ministers accused the Iranian police of being responsible for Mahsa Amini's death, claiming she was beaten and mistreated. That's while a forensic investigation dismissed allegations that she was beaten and attributed her death to an underlying condition. The EU has intentionally disregarded and dismissed documents offered by Iran proving foreign support for the riots and showing that accusations leveled against the government are baseless. The US, Canada, and the UK leveled new sanctions against Iranian authorities and entities in response to the recent unrest in Iran, and the EU followed suit. These countries say Iranians' right to peacefully protest must be ensured under any circumstances. But as Iran's foreign minister has described it, these nations have considered riots and terrorist actions as protests in interventionist comments, which in effect incite rioters and terrorists.
We need to separate the riots from peaceful demonstration. Anyone in their right state of mind will understand the difference between these two and separate them. The reality is people do have legitimate right everywhere in the world. Indeed, in Iran, it's part of the Iranian constitution. They have the right to demonstrate, but no one has got the right to commit riots and endanger people's lives.
Meanwhile, there have been plenty of instances of the Western government's widespread violations of human rights and suppression of peaceful protests in their own countries, particularly in the EU. Serious human rights violations, including corruption, human trafficking, racism, and discrimination, persist across Europe, while unemployment and poverty in many countries are nurturing extremism and conflict. Therefore, Iranian officials say the EU cannot impose sanctions on Iran as long as countries within the bloc are violating human rights.
This is IRIB English Radio. please log on to our website, www.parstoday.com/en.
انسان را مطمئن می کند ذکر خدا ذکر الله تطمئن القلوب.
Be aware, the hearts find rest in Allah's remembrance.
Spring of truth. This is a part of political divine will of the founder of Islamic Republic of Iran, Imam Khomeini. Selfish people and followers of Taghuts abuse the Holy Quran as a means by which to establish anti-Quranic rules. This deviation reached a point where the rule of the glorious Quran in the hands of the oppressive rulers and their wicked clerics who were more corrupt than the Taghutis was distorted and abused as an instrument to continue their oppression and corruption and to justify the wrongdoings of the enemies of Allah. Unfortunately, the glorious Quran, which is capable of helping mankind to find this path in life, was not given a role other than to be recited in ceremonies because of plots of its mischievous enemies as well as ignorant friends.
Bismillah ar-Rahman ar-Rahim. Assalamu alaikum wa rahmatullahi wa barakatuh. Welcome to the program Spring of Truth from IRB English Radio. I'm your host, Sayyid Mohsin Naqvi, with the viewpoints of Imam Khomeini in regards to the prayers. In one of his speeches, Imam Khomeini has mentioned that the Friday congregational prayers are above all other affairs. Now, in this part of his speech, basically he's referring to the position and the main goal of the Friday prayers, that when we offer these prayers, since we know that in Friday prayer there are two sermons, the first one which calls people towards the taqwa or towards the piety or towards being God-weary. On the other hand, the second sermon is related to the very important point in the Islam, and that is the political affairs and the current affairs that are going on. Therefore, the person who leads the Friday prayer, he has to talk about the current affairs, the issues of that week, or the issues in the world, in the community.
Ya Rabbana, salli ala Taha al-Nabi wa alihi. Sallallahu alayhi.
Is mentioning that this Friday congregational prayers is above all other affairs. Why? Because in this Friday congregational prayer,
We know that everyone joins these prayers. Everyone comes to the prayer. So even the people who were unable to come to the five-time prayers, maybe they were missing some prayers or some days, they are coming on the Friday congregational prayers. Why? Because it's a holiday and then everyone meets. Therefore, it is also known as a small Eid. Why? Because people see each other, they meet each other. A big number of people, they come and join one prayer. And generally, it is like one Friday congregational prayers in one city. But we know that in different countries, they are having different ways. When everyone is joining, they are discussing their issues, they meet each other. If there are any issues, if there are any problems, it gets solved in the Friday prayer or maybe after the Friday prayer, where people have issues when they see, for example, the management or when they see a minister or someone who can do or the authorities. They meet each other, they talk to each other, and they try to solve their issues. So this is the main goal of the Friday prayer, and therefore it is above all the other affairs, inshallah.
Assalamu alaikum wa rahmatullah.
Hello everyone and welcome back to another episode of The Subcontinent.
The Subcontinent.
Hello everyone and welcome to another episode of The Subcontinent. On this program, we will address the most important issues in the South Asian region that affect the governments, organizations, communities and most importantly, the people. And as always, we will dissect the issues and present you with different perspectives from experts and people. So, stay tuned.
In this edition of The Subcontinent, we will discuss the fresh developments in the months-long hijab controversy in India, as well as blatant hypocrisy of some Indian celebrities on the route. And we shall also look at the U-turn by the Indian government on granting voting rights to non-local Kashmiris in Kashmir following widespread protests.
In yet another twist to the simmering hijab row in India, the country's apex court just recently delivered a split verdict on petitions challenging a provincial court verdict on the hijab ban in government schools. India's Supreme Court referred the matter to the Chief Justice for the Constitution of a larger bench. It came exactly 7 months after a top court in southern India's Karnataka state upheld the hijab ban, dismissing pleas by Muslim students who demanded the right to wear hijab in classroom.
A high-profile panel of judges at India's top court issued a split verdict on October 13th. One of the judges dismissed appeals challenging the order of the Karnataka High Court on the hijab ban in government schools in the BJP-ruled southern Indian state. Another judge said the Karnataka High Court has taken the wrong path, arguing that wearing a hijab is ultimately a matter of choice. Given the divergence of opinion, the matter has now been referred to the top judiciary official to set up a bigger bench. In December 2021, a government college in Karnataka's Udupi district barred Muslim students from joining classes wearing hijab. Subsequently, other colleges across the state also enforced the ban. In February, the right-wing government in the state issued an order banning Muslim students from wearing hijab in classrooms, sparking protests by students and their parents. The ban was in March upheld by the state's top court, which prompted some Muslim students to challenge the ruling in the Supreme Court. Critics have termed the hijab ban another move to marginalize the minority Muslim community in the Hindu-majority country. Muslims, who account for more than 15% of the country's 1.4 billion population, have faced numerous existential challenges since the BJP rose to power in 2014.
Many Indian film celebrities and prominent television journalists have been called out in recent weeks for displaying selective outrage and blatant hypocrisy by keeping silent over the hijab ban in India while issuing hysterical statements on foreign-backed anti-hijab protests turned riots in Iran. Priyanka Chopra, a Bollywood actress who has now moved to Hollywood, has in particular faced scathing criticism for condemning the recent death of a young woman in Iran while maintaining silence on the government-sanctioned ban on Muslim headscarves in her home country.
In recent weeks, the death of Mahsa Amini in Iran has laid bare blatant double standards of self-righteous celebrities, influencers, activists, and journalists across the world.
The death of 22-year-old Mahsa Amini.
While they have allowed themselves to be swayed by Western propaganda mills dishing out misinformation on Iran, they have obdurately refused to comment or condemn the rampant abuse of human rights in other parts of the world. One such example is Priyanka Chopra, a leading Indian film star, now a big name in Hollywood. Last week in an Instagram post, Chopra told her 82 million followers that she was in awe of women protesting in faraway Iran. The post backfired badly, with many grilling her for keeping silent over the hijab ban in India and the relentless persecution of minority Muslims in her country. Foreign-backed rioters in Iran. One of them was India Today editor Geeta Mohan. Her publicity stunt proved counterproductive, as people wondered whether she would also wear hijab on air in solidarity with Muslim girls barred from wearing headscarves to schools in India.
Now, to have more insight on this, we are joined by Mr. Ahmed Hussain, spokesperson for the Muslim Public Affairs Committee in the UK. It's glad to see you, Mr. Hussain. Now, how do you view the Indian Supreme Court split verdict on the hijab controversy? And is it in favor of Muslim students who have challenged the ban or the right-wing government in Karnataka?
So this ruling was supposed to be conclusive between two judges from the Supreme Court, but however, it wasn't, because the two judges came to a loggerheads with opposing conclusions. One of the judges, Dulia, he was against Karnataka's initial ruling in the first place because he believes that this is an issue of personal choice, personal dress codes, how women want to dress. It's not something for the courts to wade in on. However, his peer, Gupta, believed that Karnataka's hijab ban ruling should stand. And very curiously, he used strawman arguments like the right to dress will include the right to undress also. But to answer your question, any ruling from the Supreme Court is going to be an interpretation of rights as laid down by India's constitution. So this means that the real question is India's constitution fit for purpose when it comes to safeguarding the rights of minorities like Muslims? And when I see recent laws around citizenship or recent amendments to the constitution itself regarding Kashmir, the answer has to be no.
Mr. Hussain, what about the Karnataka High Court, which in March upheld the government ban on wearing hijab in classrooms in the southern Indian state? Now, do you expect the Supreme Court's bigger bench to take a more holistic view?
So the debate could now be taken to a larger bench, and who would sit on that bench would be decided by the Chief Justice, Uday Umesh Lalit. Now, something that's worth remembering is that he himself was part of the five-judge bench who ruled the triple talaq.